Hello, I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Health. Our topic today is the diagnosis and treatment of HIV/AIDS. I'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for sponsoring the program. I'd also like to thank the American Academy of HIV Medicine for their collaboration and assistance in putting this program together. And thank you to Bristol-Myers Squibb for providing the educational grant to make the program possible. Physicians and other healthcare professionals, you can earn free CME credit by registering online at discoveryhealthcme.com and taking the post-test. All the slides and references from today's program will also be available online. It's easy to log on, take the post-test, and earn free credit for the program, so log on today. We're fortunate to have a distinguished group of experts in the studio today to discuss this topic, all of whom are board members of the American Academy of HIV Medicine and are credentialed HIV specialists. Dr. Donna Sweet, Professor of Medicine, the University of Kansas School of Medicine, Wichita. Dr. David Hardy, Associate Professor of Medicine, David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. And Dr. Judith Feinberg, Professor of Medicine, University of Cincinnati. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. The diagnosis and management of HIV/AIDS is an important topic for physicians to understand. During the next hour, we plan to discuss the epidemiology of HIV/AIDS. We'll review the latest guidelines for screening for HIV infection. We'll describe the signs and symptoms of acute HIV infection. We'll explain the 6 classes of antiretroviral therapy, including approved agents in each class and those in the late-stage development. We'll outline the current guidelines for antiretroviral therapy. We'll identify approaches to resistance testing, including when to conduct testing. Describe metabolic complications most often associated with treatment of HIV/AIDS. And finally, we'll discuss strategies to improve adherence to antiretroviral therapy, including special needs of minority populations. Now, we frequently hear about the epidemic of HIV/AIDS, but Dr. Sweet, start us off with the current epidemiology.
Certainly, I think it's one of the things that's perhaps most important, that people realize this has not gone away and is an increasing problem. In this country, we have 1.2 million people in the year 2005 that are living with HIV/AIDS in the United States. If you look at that number 5 years ago, it was 800,000 to 950,000 is what they were kind of estimating. If you look at the world at large, there's between 39 and 42 million people living with this disease in the year 2005, 5 million new infections that year, 3 million deaths. So it's a huge burden of illness that continues to grow. And even in this country, right now we have about 421,000 people who are still living with a full-blown AIDS diagnosis. That's a 27% increase from the 331 that we had just 5 years ago. So we are seeing an increase in disease, and I think, Judy, you were going to talk a little bit about the increasing prevalence, the increasing incidence in our country.
Right. Well, since about 1993, the CDC has given us figures that there are about 40,000 new HIV infections every year. In the last several years, that number's risen to 45,000. Current information is that it's going to be still higher. So while this was initially primarily a disease of men who had sex with other men or people who shot up drugs, this is now increasingly a disease of the young, women, racial and ethnic minorities, and people living in rural areas.
And sadly, in addition, since 1981, since AIDS cases were being counted, over 530,000 Americans have died of this disease. That's more Americans that died in our modern world wars and other wars throughout our country. So I think that's something that's a very harrowing statistic to keep in mind. It is important to also point out, though, that death from AIDS is becoming less and less common because of our new medications and because of the fact that we can now identify persons, hopefully earlier, that this is no longer going to be such a death descent as it used to be before.
But I think it is important to always remember when you have a decrease in mortality, which we have had over the last 10 years, and continue to see 49,000 new infections every year, the prevalence of this disease, the number of patients or people per 100,000 in your community and mine that are living with this every day goes up every day.
What are the latest recommendations for screening for HIV infection, Dr. Hardy?
You know, I think that's some of the most really exciting new information that we can share with people today, especially healthcare practitioners. About a year ago, the Centers for Disease Control made a very important new recommendation, and that was universal opt-out HIV screening. And that is to offer all Americans between the ages of 13 and 64 the opportunity to have an HIV test at least once in their life. This is based upon the fact that we can no longer accurately identify people based upon what we have always done in the past, and that is perceived risk factors of sexual activity or perhaps drug use. And today, what we really want to do is to encourage health practitioners to offer their patients opt-out voluntary testing in order to be HIV tested and perhaps repeat that if they do have ongoing risk factors such as sexual activity or any drug use.
And this is important because there are an estimated between about 250 and 320,000 people in the United States who have HIV infection and don't know it. The idea is to identify people early, get them into care, get them on medication so they can avoid the whole process of getting sick and being in the hospital. And we all take care of patients now who have in fact never been sick, lead normal lives, are employed full time, have HIV negative babies, you know, do everything that a normal person wants to do in adult life and avoid getting sick. So it's crucial that we find these individuals and offer them care before they get sick.
Are these latest screening guidelines from the CDC controversial?
Certainly there are those in the healthcare industry who are not really, I think, aware or understanding the fact that largely the HIV epidemic remains undiscovered in about 250,000 people in the U.S. today. Therefore, that reason, I think some people are not quite understanding why everyone should be tested, when in fact that's the only way we're going to find out what's going on. I think there's also some public policy concerns about this, too, in terms of some advocacy groups opposing voluntary opt-out testing because of concerns about discrimination.
What we have to understand, and I think what all healthcare providers need to understand, is that in the old days, 20 years ago, when all of these laws and having to have written informed consent and prevention counseling, when all that came about, we had nothing that we could do for the patient. You know, the stigma was horrible. They could lose their family, everything that was important to them, and we didn't have much to do. But if you fast forward 20 years, we have good medications. We can give them a better quality of life. There's still some stigma, but it's nowhere near what it was.
Okay, so, but what are the signs and symptoms of HIV infection? I mean, once we've established testing.
Well, and certainly you have to look at kind of the three stages of HIV infection. The acute HIV infection is one of those things that will send many people, probably 50% of new infections, to a healthcare provider or an emergency department because it's a horrible illness. It's sort of the worst flu. It's a mononucleosis-like problem with very sore throat, high fever, 103, 104, so that when we see people like that, we need to be thinking not just, oh, this could be mono, this could be syphilis, this could be acute hepatitis. We have to think this could be acute HIV because it is important to have people understand that they have it. Their viral loads will be higher during that period of time, that is their infectiousness, than any other time in the history of their illness.
I think the first instinct is to do a mono spot test, you know, a test looking for infectious mononucleosis, because that is a very common disease and especially a common thing of adolescents and young adults. But if that test is negative, then you should immediately be thinking, oh, I better offer this person an HIV test.
And then the other two stages of illness, you have asymptomatic HIV, which is, you know, 10, 12, 15 years of time where a person, if not tested, may never know that they have it. They may have a little lymphadenopathy, a little enlargement, but nothing else.
And that's probably where the majority of people who are HIV positive in the United States are today. They're in the period after acute retroviral infection, as we call it, that has symptoms, and about half the people who actually get infected with the virus for the very first time. And before they develop the severe immune deficiency problem called AIDS, they live in a period where they have no symptoms, but they are still able to transmit the virus.
We've talked about the symptoms, but how specifically is the diagnosis of HIV infection made?
Well, the acute HIV infection, one, is a little trickier. If you do an antibody test, if they're in that first 2 to 3 to 4 weeks, which often they are when they're symptomatic, their antibody test, the standard serology, won't be positive yet. So you have to go the next step and do an HIV PCR RNA, which is an amplification. It actually looks for the virus, and they'll be very, very high titers. One has to be cautious because you can have false positives, but those are low numbers. So we really look for a viral load that's greater than 100,000, and oftentimes they're truly in the millions. And then once they're pass the acute HIV infection, either diagnosed or not, they will turn positive on a standard serology. And the traditional serology is an ELISA technique followed by a confirming assay like a Western blot or even an immunofluorescent assay. So it's serology after the acute infection. But during acute infection, you're really looking for the virus.
There's a number of different clues that clinicians can look for that tend to be subtle. And they tend to begin to happen as people drift below 400 or 350 T helper cells. And those are things like there's a range of skin disturbances, folliculitis, psoriasis, things that would happen in people who are HIV negative as well, but these are kind of nagging and persistent. For women, it's the development of vaginal candida infection or candida infection in the throat, which we refer to as thrush. So these at weight loss, and then some people will start describing some fever and some night sweats and just a loss of energy. And then if they don't get diagnosed and treated as they begin having symptoms, then, you know, they'll inexorably progress to the point of immune destruction where they will have what is described as frank AIDS.
For the providers, I think it's critical that we talk about routinization of screening for HIV. Actually, when people start showing up with these nondescript symptoms, that's the other time clinicians, providers, healthcare providers should be thinking, I'd best do an HIV test. Exclude it. Make sure it's not the reason for the fatigue. Make sure it's not the reason for the lymph nodes or the increased psoriasis. Then you can move on in your differential. But unfortunately, this test gets put down the list because people don't really think it's going to be in their population of patients.
Exactly.
As part of the program, we take questions for our expert panel. We had one question specifically about HIV testing.
Can I test negative for HIV and still be positive?
That's what that negative window or the false negative window is talking about, is that period of time where you really could have it, but your antibody hasn't turned positive yet. That is a less and less of a problem because the tests, the assays, are getting more and more sensitive, so they're able to pick up smaller amounts of antibody. And with the new wave tests that we use, some of the oral swab tests or the finger stick tests that you can have results with in 10 to 20 minutes, the sensitivity is very high, 99.8%. The specificity is very high, around the same range, 99.8%. And they test positive sooner, somewhere in the 4 to 7 weeks range.
We know that the importance of early HIV infection diagnosis is absolutely key, but there's another question that goes beyond that, and that's the question of should the acute HIV syndrome be treated immediately with antiretroviral therapies?
There have been studies on both sides which have shown that the use of the medication in some situations may in fact help in terms of lowering the amount of virus in the body, which may have some long-term prognostic benefits in terms of having less virus early on. However, there's also, on the other hand, been studies that have shown that it is not a good idea to treat because it may inhibit the body's ability to form its own immune response to the virus, which also may be important for long-term support of the person down the line.
That's when you sit down with a patient and say, we have treatment, we're not sure that we should be giving it. But quite frankly, when I've had these discussions, patients sort of look at you and say, it's a sickness, it's an infection, you have drugs for the infection, why wouldn't you treat me? So I think by and large, patients feel like a treatment is probably wise. Then the issue is, how long do you treat?
Right.
And that's the other thing that's unanswered.
When I talk to patients who are in this situation, people who have recently acquired HIV infection, what I tell them is that if we start therapy now, that they should imagine that this is going to be an uninterrupted therapy now for the rest of their lives. So they have to feel ready, because as Donna said, people who are not ready and therefore do not take the medications correctly are going to run into problems with resistance. So it's not an easy answer, but ultimately I completely agree with Donna. It's something that the healthcare provider has to have a frank and open discussion with the individual, and then it is that individual's choice, and you have to support that choice regardless of what you would do in the same situation. And then the routine part of care is to continue to follow people, and then at some point down the line they'll be readier for therapy.
So, Dr. Hardy, which patients should be started on antiretroviral therapy?
What the current guidelines actually say is that anyone who has AIDS, anyone who has a CD4 cell count less than 200, should be started on therapy immediately. So symptomatic disease definitely gets started on therapy right away. For persons who have less than 200 CD4 cells and are asymptomatic, have no symptoms, there again, their degree of immune deficiency should start therapy right away at the same time. The real controversial area comes up is that if someone is asymptomatic but has higher CD4 cell counts, say between 200 and 350, still decreased from normal, but at a point where we're still not exactly sure when we should start, this is an area where I think the science is not entirely clear and is, in fact, is in evolution right now. Mm-hmm.